United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time for argument in Webster v. Woodford. We understand counsel is ready to proceed, so appellant me.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Pat Whalen, here for appellant Warden Gene Woodford. I'd like to reserve the final 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. I wanted to begin by clarifying a position from the briefs with respect to our argument about the proper interpretation of Bowie. And the warden is advancing two arguments that are very much related but are distinct. The first is that the exact meaning of Bowie is that it only covers situations where a court expands the definition of a criminal statute to cover conduct that previously had been innocent conduct. The second argument that we're making, and which is very much related, is that even if that is not the true definition of Bowie, at the time of finality, in this case in 1992, the definition of Bowie, the scope of Bowie, was at least debatable, and therefore an interpretation of Bowie that it would cover also conduct that was criminal would be a violation of Teague. Our third argument is, of course, on the merits, that applying Bowie to the facts and circumstances of this case and the statutes at issue in this case, we win on the merits. With respect to Teague, the United States Supreme Court, in its Bowie cases, has repeatedly applied it to situations where the conduct in question was innocent when done prior to the interpretation. The examples, of course, are the situation where it's a man sitting in his car talking on the radio, or the new definition of obscenity in Miller, which prior to that time would have been innocent conduct. So although the Supreme Court has never expressly stated the exact limitations and scope of Bowie, it has, in the course of its application, has applied it to situations where the conduct was innocent.
So is your interpretation of Bowie that it's it affects substantive criminal law, not procedural criminal law? Is that what you're...
Our position is that Bowie is very much a procedural issue. The heart of Bowie is notice, is the fair warning.
Well, in this case, though, given the Supreme Court's decisions in Sadazan versus Pennsylvania and others, which considers a special circumstance to be an element of the offense, doesn't that distinguish it from the cases you're talking about?
I don't think so, Your Honor. In fact, as Your Honor found in the Summerlin decision, in discussing the difference between procedural and substantive law, what's at issue for procedural law is where you get in and actually look at the definition of a substantive statute. That's not what Bowie is about. Part of the Bowie analysis, it is true, has to do with looking at the meanings of individual state statutes. But that is not the underpinnings of Bowie. Bowie is a notice. What did the defendant have fair warning? And notice is quintessentially a procedural aspect of our criminal system. Is it fair to impose the criminal process against a defendant for conduct that he might not have known?
Right. But I think you'd agree that if you're changing the elements of a crime, that probably is quintessentially substantive rather than procedural, correct?
The act of a state court interpreting a law to expand the definition of a crime may alter substantively the definition of state law. But the constitutional analysis for this court is whether that process was within or without the Constitution, whether or not there was constitutionally adequate notice. That aspect is procedural.
Right. I think at the end of the day, don't you come down to the question of whether or not this was a radical and unforeseen change? Because if it is unforeseen, then in fact it was a substantive change in the law, and probably Teague has no application anyway. Well, and also I think that distinguishes it from the situations you're talking about, or the distinction you're trying to describe in the Bowie cases.
That may be, although I'm not entirely convinced that the merits necessarily removes the necessity to answer the threshold question under Teague. But turning to the merits, Your Honor, you hit it on the head. In order for there to be a Bowie violation, it has to be completely unforeseeable, radical and unforeseen, and so unexpected, so outlandish, no reasonable person could have expected it. And what happened in this case? This group of six people living down by the river said, okay, we need to get a car. We've been doing too many robberies. We need to get out of Dodge because it's getting too hot. So tell you what, you pack up our camp because we're going to need to make a quick getaway. You dig a grave. You hide behind that bush. We'll go up and lure this guy down away from his car, and we'll kill him, and that won't be a robbery murder. That is not reasonable. Anybody looking at that circumstance could say, gee, might the California Supreme Court impose criminal liability in this case? Of course. It is not at all unforeseen that the statute could be extended to apply to that case.
Could you help me procedurally as to when this, as to what the arguments were before the jury as to what were raised in the trial court on this question?
The jury was presented with actually four theories of first-degree murder. Robbery, felony murder, standard premeditation and deliberation, lying in wait, and murder in the course of a conspiracy. However, the special verdict forms they were given didn't really, all they differentiated between was between felony murder and not felony murder. So they didn't really specify which of the four theories, although the jury did find it, they were finding it both on felony and non-felony murder. In the course of closing argument, actually the defense counsel brought up the question of...
No, wait a minute. The jury verdict, the special verdict did not indicate lying in wait, or it did?
No, it didn't specify lying in wait. They were given three forms. One was first-degree murder under felony murder, one was murder under other than felony murder, and one was murder under both felony murder and other than felony murder. So I don't know how enlightening that was. But in any event, during the course of the argument, one of the defense counsel said, well, what was the property here? What property was the subject of the robbery? And in rebuttal, the prosecutor responded, it was either the car, but I realized that they've talked about immediate presence, and that's far away, but it was also could have been the keys that were taken from the victim's pocket at the scene. And that issue was briefed in the district court below. So the upshot is that it is unclear from the record exactly what theory or theories the jury used in determining.
While we're on that, would you enlighten me as to whether or not the instructions given were part of the standard instructions, California standard instructions, or whether there were special instructions given with respect to the special circumstances?
My recollection is they were the standard instructions. I do not believe that this case had the instruction from Hayes, the overt act language. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that was a part of this case, but I'm not certain of that, Your Honor.
Okay.
In any event, in turning to specifically the Bowie violation as to robbery and the immediate presence issue, the district court was correct when it found that the case of People v. Lavender is at the heart of this. That's the 1934 California appellate court case, which had the language spelling out the expansive definition of presence and how it could apply to a number of different circumstances. And it pointed out in language, it said, the trick or device used by the defendant to separate the victim from his property is irrelevant. That isn't going to help the defendant when he wants to come and argue about immediate presence. And that's exactly what we have in this case. These people had a premeditated plan to murder this guy. And to lure him away from the car, probably for no other reason than the car wasn't easy to get down to the river, but they separated him from the car, took him to an isolated location on the river to kill him. They lured him away from his car and killed him at a location a quarter of a mile away. The fact that you trick somebody out of their property or separate them from the property by trick does not relieve you of liability for robbery. That was clear in 1934, more than 40 years before Webster committed this crime. So he was without question on notice that it was foreseeable that the California Supreme Court could interpret the robbery statute to cover his conduct in this case. Did the California court have to interpret it to impose liability? No, they could have done a narrow construction. That would have been reasonable as well. But the fact that the court chooses the broader of two or more reasonable interpretations of the law doesn't create a constitutional violation. It's foreseeable at the time the defendant commits the crime.
Well, I guess was this dispute ruled on by the trial judge as
no.
to whether it should be narrow or broad?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. But as long as for purposes of this case, is as long as there's no buoy violation, then the verdict stands, because then under any theory that the jury might have used, they were all constitutional. The problem in this case only arises because the jury might have decided it was the car that was the subject of the robbery. And if that is a buoy violation, as contended by my colleague, then that would be an unconstitutional theory. And where you have one unconstitutional theory and you can't tell which is the one the jury used, that creates the problem.
Let's assume in this case that the defendant and his co-defendants had just stolen the key to the car without and never taken the car. Do you think that would be sufficient theft to support the special circumstance?
Yeah, property from the presence. That's, in my view, that's a much easier case. Because you're robbing somebody of property from their person. That falls squarely within the statute. So I don't think that would present a problem at all. And, in fact, that was one of the factual bases urged by the prosecutor. It's just we didn't ask the special verdict, or the prosecutor didn't elect as to make that his only theory. So
under California case law, is the theft of a key to the car considered constructive theft of the car?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. But it would still be property from the person.
No, I understand that, but...
The gravamen of robbery is not that it be a car, but just...
No, I understand. I'm just saying. I was asking a follow-up question. You were returning to the first question.
I don't have at the ready constructive definition of robbery, Your Honor. With respect to the lying in wait, the district court in this case had problems with two of the elements of lying in wait, had problems with the concealment aspect and problems with the period of watchful waiting. With respect to concealment, the district court was of the belief that what was required in California case law up until the Webster decision was actual physical concealment of the person. In fact, that is not the case. In fact, there are a number of cases which, given their facts, the victim was unquestionably aware of the presence of the killer. The case where the wife walks into the cabin and sees her husband. And she then leaves the cabin and comes back in, knowing, of course, he's still there. And then he shoots her. That was sufficient for lying in wait, despite the fact that he wasn't concealed at all. The situation where the person runs up to the house in full view of the occupants of the house and starts shooting, having previously been seen outside the house down the road about 15 minutes earlier. No concealment there. What the language of the court says is what is controlling is the intention to ambush. Okay, that's controlling, and that was 10, 15, 20 years prior to the crime in this case. Then what California Supreme Court does in this case is says what is important is concealment of purpose. Well, that is not at all an unforeseeable expansion or reinterpretation of the controlling aspect is intention to ambush. Those are virtually synonymous. So from the buoy perspective, for a person in 1981 at the time of this crime to say, well, gee, it won't be lying in wait if he sees me before I kill him, that's not a reasonable interpretation. There is no fair warning or notice problem in this case by the California Supreme Court interpreting the concealment element of lying in wait to impose liability. Because, again, what was happening here, they were walking down the trail back to the camp. Webster was behind the victim, pulls out the knife, and does a surprise attack from behind. That's the classic lying in wait. He was luring him away to a position of, where there weren't going to be as many witnesses and so on, and it was on a narrow trail where one of his cohorts was in front. He was behind. The guy couldn't get away. Classic lying in wait situation.
If concealment of purpose is all that's necessary to invoke the death penalty, it's hard to think of a first-degree murder case that wouldn't involve concealment of purpose. I mean, most of them involve some element of where, because most victims, if they think they're going to be killed, don't hang around or don't put themselves in that circumstance. So aren't we conflating the elements of capital murder by stretching that definition?
I don't think you are, Your Honor. Classic example, you and I are in a bar fight, you clock me on the jaw, and at that, you ring my bell, and I say, that's it, I'm going to kill him, and I just take out a beer bottle and smash it over your head. I had a second to reflect on it, premeditated, killed you, but probably not a
pretty rare case. That's usually a second-degree murder case.
It might, but it could be first-degree. If I said, that's it, I'm going to kill you, and I've reflected on this, spam.
I think you'd have to agree that the vast majority of first-degree murder cases in California, because they involve premeditation, usually for some length of time, involve an element probably of concealment of purpose.
They might. Fortunately, in Morales, this court has already determined that that definition of lying in wait wasn't an Eighth Amendment violation.
I understand.
And more importantly,
but we're talking about foreseeability here, so that's the gravamen of my question, because it may not be foreseeable that you're going to expand the definition of essentially first degree murder to that extent.
Well, I think in doing the foreseeability analysis, I think the inquiry should be on what could a defendant reasonably expect given the prior status of the law, and I think in that inquiry, you'd look at the previous facts and look at some of the scenarios that I described earlier and see, well, could the court use it to cover this situation? I'm not sure that part of the reasonableness inquiry for foreseeability would involve, well, what might the Eighth Amendment analysis be in terms of expanding a special circumstance to increase the number of death-eligible murder. I'm just not sure that's part of the Bowie analysis for foreseeability. I think it's really more limited to what are the facts of the case? Is it foreseeable that this would be criminal conduct or the statute would be interpreted to cover this particular conduct without regard to some of the other potential constitutional issues that may be hanging around as a result of that expansive definition? With respect to the second element of lying in wait that the district court had a problem with, and that was the watchful waiting, what the district court did is, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, it relied upon a footnote statement of facts used by the magistrate judge in its findings and recommendations on motions for summary judgment. And as this court knows, factual issues are not appropriately resolved by summary judgment, and so the facts were not really necessary to the magistrate judge's findings in Rex, and so that's why they were relegated to a footnote, just to give kind of some background context to what this case was about while it resolved the legal issues. And so in the course of adopting, for the most part, the findings in Rex, except for the Bowie claim issue, the district court apparently assumed that that was a complete and full statement of facts, notwithstanding the fact that we have a 10,000-page record from state court and that fully explicate the facts, and notwithstanding the fact that the district court judge cited to the state court record and the state court opinion, which was a full explication of facts. And in any event, relying solely on that footnote, determined that there was nothing in the record to demonstrate a period of watchful waiting, because that statement of facts in the footnote used by the magistrate judge didn't fully describe the fact that they had planned this out and were walking down the hill, and it took about a half hour to go get this guy and bring him back, and they waited for the opportune moment on the trail to ambush him. And so it was kind of an unusual holding, because it was done in the context of Bowie, but in some ways it reads almost like an insufficiency of the evidence on that element, even though elsewhere in the petition, there was a claim of insufficiency of evidence as to that issue that the magistrate judge rejected and which the district court adopted. So the district court agreed there was sufficient evidence, but in the course of this Bowie lying in wait element, found that there wasn't sufficient evidence in the brief statement of facts used by the magistrate. So our position, of course, is that there is more than sufficient evidence in the record. We've recounted it extensively in our briefs. We've referred the court to the California Supreme Court's opinion, which is an excellent and undisputed statement of facts that describe exactly the period of watchful waiting that is applicable to this case. The other problem with the district court's analysis with respect to watchful waiting is that it relied extensively on Richards v. Superior Court, which is distinguishable on a number of grounds, the most important of which is it was decided in 1983, 2 years after the criminal conduct in this case, and therefore completely irrelevant to the Bowie analysis, because the analysis is what was foreseeable in 1981 for Mr. Webster when he was contemplating his criminal conduct, not what some California appellate court case did 2 years later. That's not part of the Bowie analysis at all. So the district court was really factually and legally on very shaky ground with respect to the watchful waiting element of lying in wait. Your Honor, if there's no other questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Joseph Schlesinger. I represent the petitioner Larry Webster in this case. With me at counsel table is Wendy Peoples. In my view, Your Honors, this case presents two threshold issues that logically precede the particulars of the lying in wait and robbery questions. The first is, does Bowie apply at all to this situation, in that we're dealing with a court turning one crime into a greater crime rather than turning previously non-criminal behavior into criminal behavior? And as I understood the briefing, a respondent had raised that only as a Teague issue, that it was arguable that it applied only to the latter situation based on the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court had never done it in the former situation, and some of the language might indicate that the court sees it as the latter situation. I heard this morning that, in fact, they are intending or now adopt that as the correct interpretation of Bowie, not an arguable interpretation of Bowie. But before I address that, I want to just touch on what I think the second question is, because I think the briefs don't really flesh this one out in a whole lot of detail. But I think that's, if Bowie does apply, how does it apply? What's the difference between fair notice and foreseeability of change? Do we read a case any differently for Bowie purposes than we read it for traditional legal purposes? And how foreseeable is foreseeable? Now, I think I want to focus on the second question because I think there's a little more to say about that right now and come back to the first, unless the court wants me to jump right in on the first question and has questions about that, but I do, if time permits, intend to come back to it. Hearing no objection, I'll continue to my second question. I think that's really an important question, and in some ways it's the subtext of most of this appeal, because it, and again, how Bowie applies and what does foreseeability all mean, because I think it animates a lot of the superficial dispute between the parties, and that's respondents' contention that the petitioner is overanalyzing the cases and looking too much at holding rather than some of the discussion, and frankly, petitioner's contention in our brief that respondent is basically just cherry-picking pieces of dictum and words and phrases out of context to construct a novel theory of foreseeability. Now, I think Bowie clearly articulates the test that, for the most part, is adopted by any court that thoroughly analyzes a Bowie claim. Bowie starts with the unexpected, indefensible, unforeseeable characterization that the court has never retreated from. In the more recent case of Rogers versus Tennessee, the court talks about the core concepts of notice, foreseeability, and in particular the right to fair warning. When this court analyzes a Bowie case in some detail, it articulates a standard that's essentially identical, the hypothetical person of ordinary intelligence and what would he have understood. Unfortunately, I think this is an area where there's a lot of imprecise paraphrasing of the Bowie test, usually in cases where the Bowie claim is warranted to be frivolous and it's passed over very quickly. But respondent seizes on some footnotes and quotes from the Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Circuits about the without the slightest support test, the U.S. v. Killian alleged a radical shift test. In fact, although Killian cited and quoted in both the AOB and the reply brief, the word radical or the phrase radical shift never appears anywhere in it, or the Welton v. Nix outlandish change. Now, none of these cases have the slightest independent analysis of the Bowie test. They are simply reciting in a shorthand fashion what Bowie seems to indicate to that court, and are not purporting to modify the test in any way. So I think we're still dealing with reasonable notice, not some sort of ephemeral notice or slight or those sorts of phrases. Now, in fairness, I want to point out that the Ninth Circuit...
I'm saying there has to be an affirmative notice, something a prediction as to the future or some affirmative indication so that it can be affirmatively presumed that the law is going to go in this direction, even though there hasn't been a case with those particular facts.
I think that is one situation that comes up fairly frequently, but I'm not saying there has to be a case saying something like the question present, this case raises a question that's for another day, but if we were to decide it, we think thus and such. I don't think it has to be that strong at all. But I did want to point out, before I lose the train of thought, that the Ninth Circuit has done this too. There's a per curiam opinion from 1982 in a tax protest case. It starts off with, this appeal is frivolous, and in one sentence says the Bowie claim is frivolous because there's no radical shift here. And the radical shift gets repeated in a couple of other cases, including the Hayes case recently. But I think in fairness, the test is really reasonable foreseeability.
Are we free to disregard the Hayes case? I mean, as a panel, we're bound to what other panels say.
But it's not holding. It's just a statement that there's no radical shift. There's plenty, and if we want to view it or concerned about viewing it as intra-circuit conflict, there are plenty of cases in the circuit, Poland versus Stewart, that actually discussed the test in fair amount of detail that stated in a way much more favorably. So I think it would be unfair to say that Hayes holds that Bowie, when it said unforeseeable, actually meant unforeseeable in the sense of it being radical. Now, it's fine to say our citations are better than theirs or our quotes are better than theirs, but I think I really can back up that there is some content to the foreseeability test. And I can do that by comparing and contrasting the leading U.S. Supreme Court cases on this, Bowie and Rogers versus Tennessee. Bowie, where there wasn't adequate notice, and Rogers, on the other hand, where there was. And just to go through them quickly, in Bowie, what was not adequate notice of the fact that the trespass statute might be interpreted to include the protesters' refusal to leave the lunch counter was it was not adequate that the protesters expected they were going to get arrested. It was not adequate that the civil trespass laws in South Carolina had already been interpreted that way. And it was not adequate that other states had interpreted virtually identical criminal trespass statutes the same way South Carolina had. Now, in Rogers, what did it take to be on adequate notice? Rogers dealt with the year and a day rule. You can't be convicted of a murder unless your victim dies within a year and a day of the murderous attack. It's only manslaughter. Justice O'Connor, writing for the court, wrote in some detail there was lots and lots of notice here. The year and a day rule was an antiquated relic with no modern validity, she says. It had only the most tenuous foothold in the law of Tennessee to begin with, so there's no real reliance interest in the case at all. And many other jurisdictions had recently considered whether to get rid of the doctrine and had done so. So there were these three very strong signs that the times they are a change in, so getting back to your question, Judge Clifton, about, yes, you can be on notice if things are changing, and you don't have to have exact notice that they're going to change in your jurisdiction a particular way. But in addition to those three things that Justice O'Connor found, she also went to some length to point out that this was a common law doctrine, and we weren't dealing with a matter of statutory interpretation, and foreseeability issues have less importance when we're talking about the common law. And also pointed out that it really wasn't a reliance case at all, because there was no indication that Wilbert Rogers set out to kill his victim, but to make sure the victim would linger for a year and a day so that he could only be convicted of manslaughter rather than murder. So although Rogers tells us about foreseeability in a Bowie context, I think the important points about it is there's a lot of foreseeability, and the court relies to a great extent on the fact that it's not really a notice case at all, unlike this case.
Well, tell me, enlighten me, because I haven't done exhaustive research here. Enlighten me on how many times we have actually recognized a Bowie claim. Bowie itself comes out of a highly charged historic context.
Yes, and not many Bowie claims win, and the ones that do win tend to be sympathetic cases. And I think none of us are naive enough to think that there's not some normative basis for some of these decisions. Bowie, civil rights protesters, and there were lots of attacks being made in that case, and the claim that's ultimately won was one of the narrowest. And Wilbert Rogers, who lost, did set out to kill somebody. So, but that certainly doesn't suggest that the doctrine only applies in the case where the court has an innocent person.
Can you just enlighten me as to what kinds of claims have been victorious?
There's a few cited in our brief. I actually forget what the underlying facts were. There's the Devine case out of the Tenth Circuit. There's a couple of others there. But often they do tend to be someone who wasn't guilty of anything.
Right. Is there any... I'm just wondering if you can point out a case where there was somebody who was committing a serious crime, but it just wasn't quite this one, perhaps, under the previous law.
In honesty, Judge Schroeder, I can't think of a case where there's a very serious crime like murder that the Bowie claim was successful on. Of course, it's entirely possible, but I can't think of one.
So we would be the first, huh?
I'm not sure about that.
Well, it would be interesting for us to know that.
I would be happy to take a look back
at
our cases.
Okay. If you don't know.
But no, I don't know as I stand here.
That becomes important because the fair warning basis of it, I mean, you're sort of detached from reality here. Just as you say, Mr. Rogers didn't set out to kill in a way that caused the victim to linger more than a year and a day. I think it's probably fair to say that your client didn't set out to kill in a way that separated the victim from the automobile by a quarter mile, raising all of these questions about whether it's sufficiently connected to the robbery.
And there's discussion in the cases about this point, that really we are dealing with a legal fiction. There's a Justice Holmes opinion that criminals don't read statutes before they decide whether they're going to commit crimes. And in the Bowie context, I think it's the Tenth Circuit picks up on this and says, and certainly criminals don't go out and read cases. So we are, in a way, talking about the principle of it more than the reality of it. But given that we're talking about principle and what is actually out there, I think it's very important to realize that the situation with California robbery and the Lavender case is almost the polar opposite of Rogers and some of these other cases about the winds of change.
Why isn't the theft of the keys enough to sustain a special circumstance? That obviously was done off his person.
That's actually disputed, Judge Thomas.
But it was argued to the jury.
It was argued, but there was evidence on both sides.
Right. So let's just assume that it was the keys. Why wouldn't that be enough to support a special circumstance of robbery, the immediate presence requirement of the robbery?
If we're assuming that we know that that's the theory of the jury, special verdict or something.
Yeah, don't fuss with my question. I'm just saying, is the theft of the keys enough to support a special circumstance? I probably put it in artfully, but
it may be. But and this was briefed in the district court and conceded by respondent that we have a Stromberg problem because it was argued both ways to the jury that the forcible taking of the key,
right,
if that's what happened, and the forcible taking of the car both supported the robbery, and there's no way to know which the jury found so that the robbery conviction.
But the taking of the keys alone, even if the robbery of the car hadn't occurred, would be enough to support special circumstance.
I hadn't thought about that, Your Honor, and I hadn't researched, but my reaction is that it probably is. It probably is a robbery because
do you have any
something of value.
And do you have any opinion on whether under California law theft of a key is constructive theft of a car?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would tend to doubt it, but that's just my opinion based on having practiced in the field for a while. So back to the point about Lavender, we have a California statute that's been in effect for about 150 years at the time. It's been construed countless times in thousands, maybe 10,000s of cases to find foreseeability. Someone, I've had to dig and dig and dig for a case, and there's only one that talks about luring, and it's dictum, and it's 47 years old at the time of the offense, and it's never been cited by any other case for a luring proposition. It's been cited
but
about...
But do you have any authority to give us that says to the contrary, that luring is not robbery, that luring, that separating the victim from, in this case, the automobile, has to be done by force, that luring doesn't work?
Well, I think Bowie answers that. It's the you start with the notice that the statute provides, and the statute says the property has to be taken from not only the presence of the victim, but the immediate presence. So Bowie also tells us you can't simply stop at the statute if it's been given interpretive gloss by the case law.
How do you
the
deal
question
with
then is the case law has ever expanded it, not whether the case law has ever said, no, it means what it says. So I don't think the converse works at all. The question has to be, have they ever indicated that it adequately, that it would apply when there's no presence or immediate presence, but a luring constructive theory of immediate presence?
Well, what about People versus Horns on that theory? That's a 59 case where the gas station attendant was taken away from the presence of the where the robbery was taking place, and liability was found citing Lavender.
Right. He was forcibly taken out of the presence. So it's a very unremarkable holding. There are many, many cases in California, elsewhere, I presume, that say it's still a robbery if you forcibly get the person out of the presence of the property and then go back and take the property. So, yes, Horns does cite Lavender for this idea that presence is an elastic concept and all that, but it's just a very straightforward use of force.
Well, they don't talk about force in Horns, though. I mean, they talk about the trick or device by which the physical presence of the clerk was detached. They're citing Lavender with approval from under his protection and control should not avail the defendant's claim the property was not taken in the immediate presence.
Right.
They're citing Lavender, and they put the trick or device phrasing in Lavender in italics to emphasize that. So it seems to me, I mean, your argument is it's distinguishable because it was by force, but that doesn't seem to be the way that the California Supreme Court analyzed
it. Well, then at best, we have two cases using this phrase.
Was there a logical reason why force should make it different? I mean, if the issue here is presence, detaching from the immediate physical adjacency, is there a logical reason why force should be treated differently than trick?
Because it's in the statute. Robbery is a taking by force. So I think the cases are explainable by you can take the person away from the property or you can take the property away from the person. It's really.
But here we're talking about presence. I mean, the issue is the definition of presence.
Right.
So granted, force has to be part of robbery, but there's no doubt there was force involved in this crime as well. So
statute provides the force has to be used to take the property from the person's presence. So pointing a gun at someone and saying, let's get out of here while my Confederate empties your cash register, is taking the person, separating the person and the property by force. There is the use of force in the immediate presence of the property. So I think it's a very important difference.
Well, what's different? I mean, let's assume that the victim in this case had been forcibly taken away from his car. And that's different, and so it's a hypothetical. But That would satisfy the immediate presence requirement.
Absolutely. No question about that.
I guess I echo Judge Clifton's questions. What does force have to do with immediate presence? I mean, here you basically you have the same circumstance as the gas station tenant Horns, where you're separating the person from his property, and yet Horn and then citing Lavender talks about that's constructive immediate presence. I don't understand where force comes into it, because there's obviously force applied here to get the keys to the car.
It's the use of force to remove property. Use of force to remove property from the victim's immediate presence. So it comes up because it's right in the statute. And even the California Supreme Court says you can't just simply say there's a use of force on someone somewhere and then property's taken and that's a robbery.
But would it be a robbery if something stopped it? Suppose you're trying to take the car. Hypothetical, not these facts. You're trying to take a car. You take somebody away from the car, but you never actually move the car anyplace. Is that robbery? Just because they've removed the victim from the physical property rather than removing the property from the victim?
It probably is uncompleted, so it may be an attempt if something stops. But it is still satisfied the element of the use of force to separate. Now, they may
but there's no, going back to the facts of this case, there's no question but that force was used at some point. So no question that the requirements of robbery are satisfied. The issue is whether the separation, whether the personal presence element, there's something unique about force there.
Right, there's the use of force, no question about that. But the element is the use of force to separate the victim from property that's in his immediate presence. So it doesn't meet that element.
I return to the concealment before your time runs out, or lying and waiting in the concealment.
Sure. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question on that, which is I asked your colleague. It looks to me as though this is a standard instruction. Is that true?
I don't know that he got the exact Calgic instruction on lying in wait. Around this time, a lot of the cases were getting modified instructions. Morales, I think, got them modified. But the essence of that the concealment is that which results in an attempt to take the victim by surprise or something was in the standard parlance at the time.
Yeah, there's a case, Ashley, that uses the same language, and that's what led me to believe it was probably a standard instruction. But the instruction given said, together with concealment by ambush or some other secret design.
Right.
Now, if my assumption is correct, and that's part of the standard California instructions, why isn't that sufficient notice?
Because what that instruction is referring to is not a situation where there's no concealment whatsoever. The other design or the other secret design is, I believe, an attempt to capture those cases where the attack is not from the position of concealment. That because ambush, as it was used in the old California cases, meant a classic situation where you're in hiding, the person doesn't even know where the shots are coming from. And the other secret design comes from cases where they say it's still lying in wait. If you come out of hiding at the last minute or you do some other thing that the victim actually ends up seeing you.
Well, actually, I was talking about the argument on concealment of purpose being a new, a surprise. And the jury instruction given, which was also given in Ashley some years before, is some other secret design to take the other person by surprise, which would seem to me could be rationally interpreted as concealment of purpose.
It is loose, and that's why we go to the cases that language comes out of to see what they're actually about. Because, again, it's reasonable notice. What's all the information out there? Not cherry-picking. Well, the instruction seems to mean, it could be interpreted to mean this, which is the instruction's just I don't know that it has actually any status as
well. No, I think it has a status of notice, though, if we're talking about Bowie. I mean, if, in a sense, people are trying to codify case law into a standard set of instructions, we know they're subject to interpretation by courts and potential modification. But on the other hand, if a reasonable person could construe this instruction as saying some other secret designed to take another person by surprise as equivalent to concealment of purpose, which I think is not an unreasonable interpretation, it's hard to see how it's unforeseeable.
Well, the
1981.
Now we've moved not only from requiring folks to constructively read all the cases out there to find dictum about luring and that sort of thing. Now they have to go out and find what the instructions are being given. Those typically aren't even in the cases. But
the instructions suggest what whoever drafts the model instructions or the trial judge, if the trial judge is formulating one for himself or herself, what their understanding of the case law is would not seem, unless there's something erroneous about the instruction, and there has not been a successful claim here that the instruction was erroneous or contrary statement of California law, that seems to suggest that this is within the realm of a reasonable reading of the California case law.
Right, but the instruction doesn't give any attempt to say concealment of purpose is all that's required. It's a phrase lifted directly out of Tuthill, Sudik, Ward,
well,
and McNeil.
Is another construction or another instruction given to the jury where a physical concealment is identified as an
element? Well, this is part of the problem. This actually started in all these cases as a sufficiency of the evidence claim. Morales, Webster, and Edwards, which is one of the other leading cases on this, all started out by saying there was insufficient evidence of lying in wait because there was no evidence of any physical concealment. And in Morales, the California Supreme Court said, well, that's not what this instruction or what the law requires. So it turned into a Bowie situation as the court interpreted that phrase from Tuthill, Ward, Sudik, and Thomas in a different way than it had been used in those cases. Yes, if you take the language out of context to those cases and what the cases were about and what the language was trying to describe, you could say, well, this is kind of vague. It might give some notice that not very much is required. But that's just the same problem as saying we don't really need to read the cases. We can just take some phrases out of them and say, well, this looks like it's foreshadowing the result here. I see him. About 2 minutes, I guess.
You don't have to use it all.
Well, I wanted to make sure I addressed all the questions. I passed over the Teague question quickly. I think it's adequately addressed in the brief. I think Summerlin controls if the right to be sentenced by a judge, a jury rather than a judge, is substantive. I think clearly the definition of the crime as it was in effect at the time it was committed is substantive. I think there's absolutely nothing to the claim that Bowie, in reality, leaving aside the Teague spin on it, only applies to these other situations is completely without merit. This court has applied it several times in just sentencing type issues. Other courts have done it. Rogers never would have come out the way it did because Rogers was clearly guilty of a manslaughter. The court could have simply said, Bowie doesn't apply to you. Same with Lanier, the Judge Lanier, who was sexually assaulting women in his chambers, and the issue was whether that was a civil rights violation. If Bowie only applied to completely innocent behavior, Judge Lanier never would have gotten Bowie relief. So I will sit down at this point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, if Mr. Webster stabbed Mr. Burke in his car and took his car, that's a robbery-murder. If he stabs him outside the car and takes his car, it's a robbery-murder. If he pulls the knife and drags him away from the car, my colleague has acknowledged that's a robbery-murder. What he wants this court to hold is that by not showing him the knife and luring him away a quarter of a mile and then stabbing him and taking the car is somehow not a robbery-murder. Not even that. He wants to say that for a court to consider imposing robbery murder liability would be completely unforeseeable. And that is just not a proposition that holds, Your Honor. Judge Schroeder asked about situations where there have been buoy winds, and those are a number of them from the U.S. Supreme Court are identified at pages 21 and 22 of my brief, but a number of those situations where, for example, where a gentleman was on probation, one of the conditions of probation was that he had to report all arrests to his probation officer, and he got a traffic citation, which up until that time had never been considered an arrest. And then, of course, his probation was violated, and he said, but wait, I didn't know I was supposed to report that. And the court said, no, you're right. That novel interpretation of a traffic citation to mean an arrest was unforeseeable, and that's violates the fair notice concept. Interestingly, all of those cases where there were buoy winds in the U.S. Supreme are situations where it was innocent conduct up until, I mean, the guy wasn't really violating his probation.
But the Supreme Court's never said it had to be.
No, it didn't. All we can do, they haven't said one way or the other, and that's the key to my Teague argument, is we don't know.
What about Rogers? I mean, Rogers winds up saying that it doesn't apply, but there was never any question in Rogers that the conduct was misconduct. It wasn't innocent. And yet the court went through a buoy analysis.
You're right. Rogers is interesting, Your Honor, because as applied to the facts of that case, you're right, even without the year and a day rule, I think in Tennessee it would have been reduced to, Justice Scalia said in the dissent, it would have been a manslaughter. The appellant was arguing that it should have been attempted murder. But either way, it would have been criminal conduct. You're correct. Two things, though, in Rogers. In Rogers, Justice O'Connor does echo the very same language that says the heart of buoy is notice that the conduct was criminal. So they don't expressly address it even still in Rogers, but as applied to that case, it did cover conduct that admittedly was criminal. But here's the key. Rogers postdated the date of finality in this case. Date of finality for Teague purposes in this case was 1992. Up until at that point in time, the issue is, was the meaning of buoy debatable? Was it debatable among reasonable jurists that buoy might only apply to situations where the conduct was previously innocent and then had been made criminal? If we say that Rogers answers that question adversely to the warden's position in this case, that doesn't answer whether or not Teague...
I take it you're not conceding that point, are you?
No, because it really wasn't specifically addressed, and I don't know if that was even advanced in the Rogers case.
Why didn't you make this good argument in front of the district court?
Your Honor, in researching the briefs, we did advance the argument of
Teague Light or something.
Well, I didn't exactly say Teague, but I did advance
the
argument about what the meaning of buoy was, that buoy only covers.
Right. Well, I accept that argument, but you know it is, and I realize we're midstream in the district court case. I may be different, but.
Actually, Your Honor, you raise an interesting question because the way the buoy claim even came into this case is actually rather astounding. It was kind of inserted. If you look at footnote 49 of the findings in Rex, the magistrate judge says, I know this claim isn't really in the petition, but I'm going to go ahead and rule on it because I figure they'll probably amend it anyway. And then Judge Carlton, at oral argument, says, you know, I'm kind of thinking buoy might be the way to go here. So, of course, subsequently, petitioner amends to add it. We opposed, obviously, to no avail. So you're right. It did kind of get injected into this midstream. Nevertheless, this court does have discretion to consider the Teague argument. And, in fact, in Shiro v. Risley, the Teague argument was asserted much later, and the U.S. Supreme Court still said the court has discretion. And your sister circuits have said, unless there's a compelling reason in interest of justice to find it waived, or unless it's expressly waived by the state, the court should consider the threshold Teague question.
A question on that I actually should have asked when you were here earlier. You described this as being... like quintessentially, you said procedural. And I'm puzzled because I think of criminal procedure, I think more of the, you know, the search and seizure or so forth. This seems somewhat more substantive. Why do you say this is procedural?
This is admittedly tricky, and here's why. It's because when courts are tasked with doing the constitutional buoy analysis, what they have to do necessarily is go in and look at the state law, the evolution of state law, what was the state of the law at a given point in time. Okay? What they cannot do, what a federal court absolutely cannot do, is decide what the state law is or what it means. You must defer to the California Supreme Court's decision in this Webster case of what is and what, according to the California Supreme Court, always has been the definition of robbery or the definition of lying in wait. This court can't change that. The only analysis that this court does had nothing to do with the substance of what the law is the procedural aspect did the defendant have constitutionally adequate fair warning?
Right, but it's not a question of substance because, in a sense, it's a judicial ex post facto analysis in a sense, and that is quintessentially substantive. I mean, what we're talking about is was the law changed in a way that actually changed the elements of the crime here?
But the determination of whether it was a constitutionally significant change has to do with whether the defendant procedurally was on notice. Was the nature of the evolution of the state law such that a defendant could reasonably foresee this holding? That has to do with procedure. What was the state of the law? How was it developing? What facts and cases and circumstances?
What you call that procedural. What's procedural about that? That has to do with the state of the law. What's the definition of the crime?
But, again, the constitutional test that this court applies doesn't look at what the elements of the crime should be. It only looks at when the California Supreme Court...
We do that all the time. We have to render decisions based on our understanding of state law which we are not free to interpret. We have to turn to the highest court of that state. But that's something we do all the time. I don't think of that as being procedural.
Well, not every interpretation, not every constitutional issue that involves the interpretation of state law, I mean, may or may not be depending on the nature of the claim. But the Bowie claim itself has at its heart notice. Was the state's criminal prosecution applied against a person without adequate notice? And when you get to issues like notice, you know, the sufficiency of pleadings or things like that, those are always characterized as
this may be a, is this a glass half full or half empty? What is the significance of it in your view of it being procedural or substantive?
Well, it has to be procedural. That's a condition antecedent to the Teague argument. So if it's substantive, as Summerlin indicates, then Teague has no application.
And you didn't make that argument to the district court?
I did not.
Let me ask you this. Do you think an ex post facto challenge is purely procedural?
I think
because what you seem to be saying that if you use the words due process, it's automatically procedural.
I don't mean to be that cavalier about it, Your Honor. I think the ex post facto situation is a little bit different because there you are doing as the court statutory construction in the first instance, and then from that determining whether or not that was
right. Go ahead.
The problem I'm having with your Teague argument is that generally notice means. It's a factual question, whereas what we're talking about here is really a legal question, isn't it, as to the interpretation of the statute?
Agreed, but as counsel pointed out, I mean, we are engaging in the legal fiction here of what a reasonable defendant would have known based on the extant case law and statutory interpretation.
No, but it's not a factual question of what did.
Absolutely.
Like, was this guy not negligent and not knowing?
Right.
This? It's not
subjective at all. It is an objective test, what the reasonable person should have reasonably known based on the extant case law.
Well, in Summerlin, basically what we said on that point was that certainly you may have a change in law that's part procedural, part substantive, but in effect, if you're changing the substantive elements of the crime or affecting some effect on it, making some effect on that's a sufficient substantive to take it out of Teague. And here we're basically saying, well, what were the elements of capital murder in California during that period of time? And if there were a significant radical change in the elements of capital murder, then Bowie applies, and if there weren't, it doesn't. It seems to me that's a substantive inquiry.
The language that I found compelling in Summerlin, Your Honor, was where you indicated that Ring affected a redefinition of Arizona's criminal law. After Ring, Arizona's criminal law actually had changed. Okay. In this case, the Bowie violation, it doesn't change the law. That's the whole point, is that the California Supreme Court is saying this has always been the law, or at least it was up in the air until we decided. And in fact, no one is saying, even if there's a Bowie violation in this case, no one is saying that we can't still apply the expansive interpretation to another robbery case. Okay? The California law has not been changed here. It is what it is, it was, and it remains. It's only whether this defendant or a reasonable defendant had adequate notice of it.
That sort of conflates the argument, though, again, because you're taking the assumption that there was no change in the law. Now, the Bowie analysis says, was there a change in the law? Did a judicial interpretation change the law? So as I understand your Teague argument, of course, Teague theory is you shouldn't apply procedural rules retroactively. What you're saying under Teague, if I understand your argument correctly, is we shouldn't apply, we should use Teague so that we can apply a change in substantive law retroactively. It seems to me that's antithetical to the underlying theory of Teague.
That's actually, I'm not asserting that, Your Honor. I'm asserting that the nature of the Bowie violation itself has to do with notice, not an actual interpretation of what the state of law
okay.
in California is.
I think we understand your position on that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time has expired. That concludes the argument in this case in this court's calendar for this morning. The court stands adjourned.